Tonight I'd like to talk about green politics. And in talking with people in the village about this subject in the past couple of weeks since I've been here, I've found that there's a real range in the amount that people know or have heard about what green politics is. And so I'm going to assume that you know nothing and try to sort of fill you in a little bit. And the main thing I want to talk about tonight is, as the title indicates, the principles of green politics. Not so much the history or the possibilities, but the principles that underlie green politics, the political philosophy, which is green politics. First, I'm going to tell you a little story about how I got interested in this and a little bit about the strange, I think it's rather strange, connection of ideas that links, in my mind, the area of physics, which is my specialty, that's where my degree is in physics, my background is in physics, and this stuff called green politics. When I was in graduate school and a little bit thereafter, I kept wondering why there weren't more exciting things going on in physics. It seemed like some of the creativity, the creative edge was off of physics, and people were basically doing mechanical routine type of tasks in physics. And friends of mine and I kept saying, what's going on at the root of physics? What's going on in the philosophy of physics at the level of assumptions? Is anybody making radical challenges to the field as was done 50 years prior when Einstein and Niels Bohr and Max Planck and Werner Heisenberg and Erwin Schrödinger were making really radical challenges to the theory of physics, to the areas of physics? What kinds of things like that are being done today? And about this time, along came a fellow by the name of Fritjof Capra, who wrote a book called The Tao of Physics. Some of you probably have heard of that. It's a book that, in a sense, connects some of the ideas of modern physics with ideas of Eastern mysticism, saying that, look, there's an amazing number of parallels here. I wasn't all that interested in Eastern mysticism at the time, but it was by far the best lay exposition of theoretical physics that had been done up to that time. It was mid-70s. I was looking then at the ideas that were being developed in the philosophical interpretation of physics. And for me, they had profound implications, not just in physics, but also in society. I thought, gee, this fellow, Capra, is dealing with some powerful stuff here, new images of reality, new ways of looking at the world that I'm hearing about in other fields as well. And somebody ought to put this together into and look at the social implications and the political implications of these kinds of ideas. Well, it was about 5 years later, 6 years later, that Fritjof Capra came up with his second book called The Turning Point, in which he did exactly that. He discusses sort of the old, what he calls the old paradigm, the old way of looking at the world, and he discusses the new way of looking at the world as the physicists are seeing it. Some physicists, not all. And other people in other fields seeing the world in a little different way. And he says, what are the implications of this other way of looking at the world for the fields, in particular, the fields he was interested in, of medicine, biology, health, economics, psychology, ecology. Those are all the areas that he considered. Now, those areas are connected. They sound like a whole bunch of different topics, but they're connected by the fact that they all deal with health. He says, I'm interested in health in sort of the broad concept of health, the shalom concept of health. Health as it relates to the whole society, as it relates to body, mind, spirit, the integration of these, as it relates to health within families, health within communities, and then health among nations, and health between humanity and the biosphere, the plants, the animals, the ecology, the environment, and then how we relate to one another economically, he said, is certainly part of our health. So he looked at the implications of this new way, new paradigm, as applied to all those areas. Well, that was fine. I was real happy with that book. I still like it a lot. I recommend it highly. The bookstore had it. I think they've sold it out. but what about taking this nice theory and putting it into practice? How do you do that? How do you go about changing people's political perspective? That's the question I had in my mind, and I thought, well, golly, it would be so neat if one of the parties in this country would adopt this new way of looking at things. And unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be happening, and it wasn't happening in 83, in 84, or 81, 82, 83, about the years the Turning Point came out. And then I started hearing about this stuff called green politics, and I thought, golly, that sounds like that's got some of the right ideas in it. And it was about a year later when Fritjof Capra, the same fellow, publishes a book called Green Politics. He wrote this jointly with Charlene Spretnak, who is the editor of a book called The Politics of Women's Spirituality, which is also in our bookstore. And I haven't read it. I'd like to read it. Judging from this book, it's probably a good book. Let me, now that I've given you this strange odyssey of this crazy physicist who starts out, you know, writing physics for the masses and then decides that physics has social implications and then finally political implications, and his odyssey follows very much mine, except that he's not Christian. For me, there's an element that comes in that he's almost overlooked completely. Except occasionally he throws it in there, sort of on the side, but for me it's central. And that is, how does my Christianity inform my politics? And so as I start talking about these concepts, these principles in physics, in green politics, and in Christianity, I hope you'll kind of see how they all tie together. And that's what I'm going to try to do tonight, is to tie them together. The new physics that Capra was talking about includes concepts like the ones I've listed here, and I don't want to talk a lot about these. I've talked about them in other presentations, other nights and other days, and if you would like to talk with me more about them, I'd be glad to, but I don't want to spend the time tonight on the physics part of it. I just want to mention them. The notion of interconnectedness, that everything in the world connects with everything else, and not only connects, but is dependent. There's a dependency on everything else, and the dependency is interdependent, which means that it's not a one-way dependency. There's not linear cause and effect. This causes this, causes this, but things cause reciprocally. There's a reciprocal causality. That's what the inter prefix suggests to me. The idea of networking is very important in modern physics, of things connected horizontally, not hierarchically, but networkingly. To connect with something else, you have to be open to that other thing. So there's a lot of emphasis on openness, open systems thinking in modern physics. In the notions of quantum mechanics I spoke about yesterday, there's the idea that reality is not detached and objective out there somewhere, and we observers stand behind a thick plate of glass and look at it, removed from us. But you cannot look at things, in principle even, you cannot look at things without interfering with them or without them affecting you. It's because of this reciprocal interconnectedness. So in a sense, the world is, from the physicist's point of view, is participatory. You are involved in it. You cannot not participate because it's connected to you and you're connected to it. And that's a very intrinsic property of nature. Especially as you get down to the microscopic levels, you can't do anything, you can't look at anything without disturbing it or relating to it, becoming involved with it, affecting the way it behaves. This is very different from the concept of mastery, of being able to put things in their place and control them. The notion of control is very much lost in modern physics. You cannot predict with certainty anything. You cannot create a perfect scheme and have it evolve in time according to your plan. It always evolves randomly. It always evolves probabilistically. You can make predictions about how it might go and say 50-50 it's going to go this way or this way, but you cannot preform a system and determine how it's going to evolve. That's a very humbling experience for the modern physicist that many other folks nowadays haven't really quite gotten hold of yet. It's perspective dependent. That is, in a sense, it's not objective. It depends on who's looking at it and how they're looking. It depends on what you choose to measure, what answer you get. What questions you choose to ask determine what answers you're going to find. What framework you have, what mental framework you have, the lenses you look through, determine what theories you come up with. In effect, your ideology determines your physics. Crazy, but that's essential to the modern view of understanding of how science works. That I'm going to talk more about tomorrow when I talk about the feminist critique of science. It's very crucial that it depends, the kind of science you get depends on your perspective, your biases, your prejudices. And you cannot be devoid of prejudices, no matter how hard you try. Everybody has them. You have to function. It's indeterminate, ambiguous, complex, diverse. Somebody has called it, I'm not sure if I spelled that right, incorrigibly plural and paradoxical. There are some things in modern physics which do not make sense by any kind of sense, notion of rationality. They can be explained mathematically, perhaps, but you look at it and try to explain what you've done mathematically, and you say, that doesn't make sense. But unfortunately, or fortunately, perhaps, that's the way it is. It's very delightful. Our God has a neat sense of humor. When one of the elementary particles was discovered back about mid-50s, they had just about come to the point, the physicists had just about come to the point of wrapping up the theory, and they just about thought they had it in the nutshell. And all of a sudden, this new particle comes along that throws their theories all out of whack. And one of the physicists says, "Who ordered that? We just didn't need that. It just seems to complicate the world and add to our confusion. And yet, the world we have before us is extremely rich and there's a lot of complexity in it that seems to be inherent in it. It seems to be much more pluralistic, diverse, rich than it would need to be to even to be able to create human beings. There's a lot more to it than seems to be necessary. And we're just beginning to discover some of that incredible richness that's there. I mean, all you should need is protons, electrons, and neutrons to make atoms. And here we are, we're all bundle atoms. And yet, there's all this other stuff out there. Gamma mesons and pis and lambdas and etas and rho's and sigmas and all kinds of crazy stuff that we don't know why it was necessary. Who ordered it? Okay, there is some physics. To me, that says something about my politics. I want to talk about that. Oh, no, I want to first talk about my religion a little bit. I want to talk about two real strong principles for me in the way I read the Bible. I want to add those into that because I think they complement that very nicely. I have to look at who Jesus is, being a Christian. And when I look at who Jesus is and what Jesus says a lot of stuff. And so I try to kind of, being the physicist that I am, I try to simplify it, try to put it into boxes so I can understand it. And look for themes that run throughout the scripture or throughout Jesus' ministry. And there's two themes that really stand out, and not every Christian agrees with me, but I'm going to say them very loud and clear. One, to me, is the principle of nonviolence. And two, for me, is the principle of justice. I could read a couple of things straight out of our scriptures. Jesus is a man of love and peace who says, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, to those who strike you on the cheek, offer the other also. Does he exclude the Russians or the Russian leaders? If God incarnate allowed himself to be captured, tortured, executed, seemingly conquered by evil men without armed defense, what are we going to do who follow this God? As a sheep led to the slaughter is dumb, so God opened not his mouth. In his humiliation, justice was denied him. Why would the God of all power submit to such degradation? Why would he not use power to defend himself? Indeed, why does he not use power to defend his children today? Or the early Christian martyrs? Or the martyrs in El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua? Because, evidently, his power is not the power of arms. If we trust him, we must accept his way as the only way to peace. A second principle, I might say in passing, I'm reading from a sermon I once wrote. For 300 years, the followers of Christ remembered who he was and what he taught. They were pacifists, despite the most just of causes for which they might have fought. With a consistency found on few other subjects, early Christian writers explicitly disapproved of Christians taking part in war for three centuries. A second striking characteristic of Jesus is that he was born, lived, and died not as a rich and powerful leader that he might have been, but as a humble, suffering servant. He said he came to preach good news to the poor, to set at liberty those who are oppressed. And he made it clear that his work and that of his disciples was to heal and lift up people who were poor and people who were oppressed by their situation or by others. I was hungry, you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. And the multitudes asked him, what then shall we do? And he answered them, you who have two coats, share with those who have none. You who have food, do likewise. Love your enemies, do good, and lend, expecting nothing in return. And your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High. For he is kind even to the ungrateful and selfish. Even to the ungrateful and selfish. Be merciful as your Father is merciful. Love one another even as I have loved you. That's a strong commandment, that last one. It's stronger than the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It's love one another as I have loved you, as God loves, we are to love. It's as strong as it can get. In the early church, followers of Christ remembered who he was and what he taught. They shared very freely. And, quote, there was not a needy person among them, for as many as were possessors of lands or homes sold them, and distribution was made to each as any had need. From Acts. Paul helped to transfer apparently substantial funds from wealthier churches to those in need, and wrote at one point to the church in Corinth, saying, now I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but that as a matter of equality, your abundance at the present time should supply their want, And John taught that if one has the world's goods and sees his brother or her brother or sister in need, yet closes their heart against him or her, how does God's love abide in him or her? Two principles then to me that come out of my Christianity, which I see connected to these in a curious way, is peace or nonviolence and justice or sharing. There's a lot more to justice than just sharing. Certainly it's sharing of wealth is one aspect of justice that's suggested here, but sharing of power is another aspect that I think is really crucial. So I would put up, if I were to make a politics, made sense to me, I would put two cardinal principles of it. One is nonviolence. And the other would be justice, which both of which would require some definition, I suppose, but you've got the flavor of it from what I've read. Then I look over here, some of these ideas, interconnectedness, interdependency, participatory. What else would I like in my politics if I were to create a political philosophy that I could live with and be happy with? And I would say it should be participatory. It should not involve trying to control things all the time, but it should involve participation by everybody. That's what translates into a notion of sort of grassrootsiness. I don't want some leaders, a few leaders, trying to lead everything hierarchically. I want there to be a wide participation in my politics. So I would say participatory. Or grassroots. Grassrootsy? Let's see, what else do I want there? Justice, nonviolence. Oh, there's another one that's suggested by these concepts. It didn't come very strongly out of the sections I read, although it's part of my spirituality as well. And that is, I'd like it to take into account the earth. I'd like it to recognize interconnectedness, interdependency, openness, that everything depends on everything else, that we're a part of nature, not above nature, over nature, but that we are one part of God's creation. And so I would like to have my politics be ecological, and I'll write it this way. Deep ecology. Deep ecology means more than just trying to preserve the environment. It means recognizing all this mesh, this network of interrelatedness, and respecting that. Recognizing it not just between us and the earth, but between us and each other. That it's a principle that should guide our politics. These, I mentioned, were sort of part of a feminist critique. Feminism emphasizes participatory things. They emphasize recognizing interconnections. Relationship is very important in a feminist perspective. So I see a lot of these themes coming out in a lot of feminist scholarship and a lot of feminist writing. And to me, that's part having a world that's more inclusive and more balanced in the male and female virtues and more inclusive of men and women in all positions of power seems to me to be a valuable world. So I would want my politics as well to be feminist, or the word that I'm going to use, post-patriarchal. We've lived in a patriarchal society for 3,000 years. And I think we're moving into a post-patriarchal age. It's not necessarily, for you men who are feeling insecure about this kind of thing, a matriarchal era, but it can certainly be a post-patriarchal era, because I think we'd like to see a lot more balance in the basically male bias that our societies have. I didn't mention the one I could have put up at the very top because it would have made a nice transition into this subject. I would like my politics to have a spiritual element to it. I would like it to be, for me, it's guided by Christianity. For other people, I would like their politics to be guided by their highest moral convictions. That I feel God works not only through our churches, but also through our secular institutions, and so I want my politics to be spiritual, despite people like Jerry Falwell. Six. One more. I don't know how to draw this one out exactly, except I could have included it up here, along with participatory and grassrootsy, decentralized. That's related to that concept of non-hierarchical. Also, it suggests matter of scale. I'm basically of the feeling that things have gotten so large in scale that we've sort of lost human control of them, a feeling of human scale about things. The individual becomes less important as the scale becomes larger and larger. And I'd like to see a tendency to decentralize power, to decentralize our life functions so that we can work within organizations that have a scale that feels comfortable to us as humans. So when I put all that down as my ideal politics, it just so happens that those are the principles that the people of green politics have adopted. Green politics is a movement that started, actually I don't know where it started. It's been very active in Germany, most active probably of anywhere in the world. Growing out of the German Conservative Party, not the German Liberal Party, curiously, perhaps curiously. In this country it's curious. In Germany it's not curious because of the difference in emphases of their two political parties. But growing out of the German Conservative Party, there was a very strong environmental movement during the 70s. And combined with that environmental movement was the peace movement, especially during the late 70s, and when we start trying to put our missiles on their soil, and some of them got ticked off about that. You heard about the massive demonstrations in Germany. So there's a peace movement also feeding into the green political movement in Germany. There's a strong anti-nuclear movement in Germany, which is not only anti-nuclear missiles, but also anti-nuclear power. And they fed into the green political party in Germany. There was an alternative movement. They just call it the alternative movement, except in German. Drawing inspiration from such American and English books as Small is Beautiful and Ecotopia and Ivan Illich's work, part of the self-help movement. There's a human potential movement in Germany which feeds into the green politics. Dealing with personal growth, spiritual work, group dynamics. There's strong citizens movements in environment. There's a Marxist student movement that's fed into green politics. It's one little bitty Marxist thread that runs in there. In other green parties in Europe, they've excluded the Marxist intentionally because they don't want to, basically because the Marxists don't generally subscribe to the nonviolence principle. Most of the Marxists tend to say there's going to be confrontation and conflict, and nonviolence may be a useful tactic sometimes, but it's not a basic principle. Whereas most of the Greens in Germany and elsewhere in Europe and in Australia and in New Zealand and in the US are saying, no, nonviolence is an essential principle of the political philosophy, not just an incidental tactic. It's an essential part of the philosophy. You can see as I presented it, for me it's an essential part of the philosophy, and it in some ways implies to be nonviolent means you're going to be nonviolent to people, to women, to the earth, to the poor. It's sort of an umbrella that connects a lot of the other principles together. Yes?
I just understood you to say that they're saying that nonviolence is non...
Non-conflict?
Non-conflict.
Yes, I don't mean to say that. I'm saying that many of the Marxists, because it's built on the dialectic principle and because it has a history rooted in the notion of class struggle and class conflict, that for them, nonviolence has not been a principle of Marxism from the early times. It can be stuck on, but it's mostly stuck on as a tactic, not as the philosophy which gives birth to the movement. There are some nonviolent Marxists. I mean, there is a nonviolent Marxism, but not all or many Marxists do not subscribe to nonviolence as a fundamental principle. Many Christians don't either, so that's not saying a whole lot, I guess. Even though I would say, you know, nonviolence is at the root of Christianity, many Christians don't interpret their scripture that way, I guess.
It's interesting to put the indeterminate part with the nonviolence. I think a lot of people stop at nonviolence and they have a kind of hidden agenda. It's nonviolence, except if such and such happens.
Right.
And this has to really be recognizing that no matter how it comes out, the indeterminate part, we're still going to stick with these principles.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a willingness to give up the idea of it's this mastery business. If you're willing to die on a cross, in a sense, you've given up the notion of that you've got to be in control, that you've got to win all the time. Sometimes you're going to lose. You're not going to always be in control.
I didn't pick up where the word green comes from.
The Green Party in Germany, I think, first adopted it out of the color of trees and color of the earth. So it was from the environmental side things, the deep ecology part. There was originally called a green network or something like that in Germany before they established a green party. In this country, there is no green party. There's a green network. And there are various little local groups, some of which call themselves green and some of which don't. But recognize that they are green because they've read books like this or they subscribe to these principles. In Bellingham, where I live, just a group has been coming together since about Christmas of this last year and doesn't expect to field any candidates or do any politicking, really, but is basically kind of a self-help group that might do some politicking on a local scale, but doesn't expect to do anything nationally or internationally, at least for a long time. They abide by these principles. They discuss them a lot. At this point, it's a lot of study and not a whole lot of action, and there's some people in it that are very impatient for more action, such as trying to stop the incinerator from being built in the county and stuff like that. Yes?
The new physics, as you explained yesterday in your talk, really stresses the openness, interdependency, paradoxical natures of physics. And if you are using that for green politics, I have a problem because my understanding of politics is using a system in order to pursue a particular end. Whereas it would seem green politics would also necessarily include openness, paradoxicalness, this plurality, mm-hmm. And yet, how do these green parties, how do they remain open to change and yet pursue one particular politics?
That's a really good question, and it's a struggle. It's, for example, they've tried to run their meetings with consensus rather than doing it by majority vote as an attempt to encourage that plurality and encourage the, you know, the input from everybody, and recognizing that you can't always reach consensus. You can't always bring that into unity. And if you don't have a principle. In other words, to go from principles to platform, for example, if you're going to make a party out of it, is a real hard step. And they know that, and they fight over it all the time. The fights in the German Greens are astounding. Probably much more vociferous because everybody is respected and honored. Every opinion they're trying to value every opinion.
So that is one of their principles, is this openness to all ideas on the subject.
Mm-hmm. Very definitely.
Of course, then they have problems trying to come up with a platform.
Right. And so, yes, okay. I want to just read a couple sections from the book on green politics for about 5 minutes, and then open things up again a little bit more. We'll have about 5 or 10 minutes then for discussion. As we traveled around West Germany, talking with Green Party officials and legislators in villages and university towns and suburbs and cities, we noticed a refreshing contrast to political parties in the U.S. The Green Party is not run by lawyers. Just imagine. The broad range of occupations represented by the Green parliamentarians in the Bundestag is typical. For example, the Greens in the state legislature of Hesse contain 4 teachers, 4 sociologists, 2 social workers, a minister, a nurse who was formerly a nun, a former priest, a psychologist, a translator, a writer, a salesman, and 1 lawyer. The Green City Council in the university town of Freiburg consists of 2 homemakers, one of whom is a grandmother and formerly a farmer, an architect, and a sociologist. The profession with the largest representation in the Greens is probably teaching, and religious studies was often cited as the area of specialization among Green teachers. The church is involved in Green politics in Germany much more so than in the U.S. They don't have that sharp church-state division. And the Lutheran Church and the Catholic Church, both in Germany, have been much more activist churches than they have in the U.S. The starting point of green politics is the recognition that we find ourselves in a multifaceted global crisis that touches every aspect of our lives, our health, our livelihood, the quality of our environment and our social relationships, our economy, our technology, our politics, our very survival on this planet. The nations of the world have stockpiled more than 50,000 nuclear warheads, enough to destroy the entire world several times over. And the arms race continues at undiminished speed. While worldwide military spending is more than $1 billion a day, more than 15 million people die of starvation annually, 32 every minute, most of them children. Developing countries spend more than 3 times as much on armaments as they do on health care. 35% of humanity lacks safe drinking water, while nearly half of our scientists and engineers are engaged in the technology of making weapons. Half. I didn't know that. Half of our scientists are in weapons manufacturing. Economists are obsessed with building economies based on unlimited growth, while our finite resources are rapidly dwindling. Industrial corporations dump toxic wastes somewhere else, rather than neutralizing them, and without caring that in an ecosystem, there is no somewhere else. Modern medicine often endangers our health. That's kind of a low blow. And the Defense Department itself has become a threat to our national security, which is also a low blow for the Defense Department. Our politicians no longer seem to know where to turn to minimize the damage. They argue about priorities, about the relative merits of short-term technological and economic fixes, without realizing that the major problems of our time are simply different facets of a single crisis. They are systemic problems, which means they are closely interconnected and interdependent. There's those words, connected, interdependent. They cannot be understood through the fragmented approaches pursued by our academic disciplines and government agencies. Rather than solving any of our difficulties, such approaches merely shift them around in a complex web of social and ecological relations. A resolution can be found only if the structure of the web itself has changed, and this will involve profound transformations of our social and political institutions, values, and ideas. I'm going to quit there, although there's a nice section here. The first step in overcoming this crisis is to recognize a new paradigm. And he characterizes that new paradigm, and it's a lot of those things I've already discussed here. And he finally says, the German Greens have preceded their American counterparts in transforming this holistic theory, that stuff, into political practice. And we can learn a great deal from their successes and their errors. So the book is about the successes and the errors of the German Greens. I had thought tonight that I would talk more about each one of those points. I wanted to discuss what deep ecology really means, how it's a systemic perspective, how it involves interconnectedness and interrelatedness and networking and all that, what participatory democracy means, grassroots democracy, what the Greens mean by justice, nonviolence, and so forth. But, alas, I'd rather really spend about the next 8 minutes in dealing with any questions and comments you have, observations, criticisms, panics. and we are welcome to borrow my copy of this if you'd like to read more about it. They used to have them in the bookstore. No, they didn't. They have one copy in the library. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Before I'd ever heard of the Green Politics or Green Party in Germany, I fell into a show on television. And I now realize it was on the negative side, but it related the Green Party in Germany, and it kept flashing these pictures of Hitler and the Aryan movement, you know.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I knew nothing. I went from, so when my friend who was here was reading the book in the library, I said, what, are you interested in that? I came with the negative, and he said, well, he says, I asked him about this, but is there any basis for that or anything? And I was,
they've,
is this a criticism of
they've that? Almost never been accused in this country of being neo-Nazi or rightist. They're generally accused of being communist or leftist. Their motto is, we are neither right nor left, we are in front. And they're constantly struggling to try to maintain that idea that they're not part of the rightist flank, they're not part of the leftist side, but they're trying to say the right and left have failed us. The seeing things on this political spectrum just isn't adequate. We've got to get above this either-or business. You know, are we going to be Republican or Democrat? Are we going to be conservative or liberal? No, we're going to have new visions, and we're going to try to seek out a new way. Neither party does the nonviolence thing. Neither party interprets ecology quite the way the Greens do. Certainly the communists don't, and certainly the, the Nazis don't. the troublesome thing is that the press in this country doesn't know how to deal with things that are radically outside the realm of discourse. If they can't label it right or left, they don't know how to label it. They start out the book dealing with some of the way the press has covered it. It's been on 60 Minutes, and it's been on in Time magazine. Time calls the Greens incoherent and unrealistic, driven by romantic and dangerously simplistic longing. That's Time magazine. Outlandish, says the Washington Post. They offer virtually nothing, says the Washington Post. New York Times says, New York Times bureau chief in Bonn explained to Americans that the Greens are volatile, messianic, and far left. a charge that he included in nearly every article, even though the Greens emphatically reject the programs suggested by the left wing of the Social Democrats, not to mention the communist groups, all of whom embrace the fetish of open-ended growth as blindly as do the conservatives. They say, no, we don't want open-ended growth. We want limited growth. We want simple lifestyle, simplified lifestyle. And this decentralization notion is, you know, very different. Yes.
It may be a poor application, but it seems to me a little bit of what I've learned about the way China's trying to develop as a modern country, but yet with limits that the Chinese governing people may, in terms of people who actually have power, closer to some of this.
Yeah, really, you know, the closest thing I know of that's realistically trying to work in this direction is Nicaragua. And it's labeled communist, too. I mean, where you try to do things at the grassroots, local level as best you can, where you try to deal with finite resources and try to decentralize. They're trying to have more female participation in Nicaragua than in any other Latin American country. Latin America is terribly macho. I mean, that's where the word comes from. And yet Nicaragua has set as a principle to try to the integration of women into the political processes. The spirituality is there in Nicaragua in some ways.
I certainly feel like a lot of the peace and justice groups that have a religious base are, you know, I mean, I had not heard anything about green politics other than, you know, I had heard the name and that was it. But the things that you've mentioned have certainly been a part of the peace and justice movements. And not necessarily within one denomination, but in most cases, I have been a part of a group in the last 4 years that has been from several denominations, because, you know, there's been a few here and there, and we come together to support each other.
They're pretty radical. I mean, when they're talking about things like unilateral disarmament, they're saying the only resistance we should have would be a social, nonviolent resistance, sort of Gandhian. And in fact, some of the right leaders in this party are developing the notions of social resistance, looking at historical examples, but extending those and saying, how do you prevent an oppressor from oppressing? How do you prevent discourage an invader from invading apart from using weapons of war? And there's all kinds of ways. There's all kinds of ways when you start forcing yourself into the nonviolent practice. Some of them have been tried, some of them have failed, some of them have worked historically. But the Greens are trying to extend that theory. If they're against putting American missiles into Germany, of course they're going to be labeled communist in this country, because anybody who's the enemy of us automatically becomes communist. So, and us means our government, our administration. So, other comments? Oh, I didn't mention that the reason I mentioned Germany a lot and the reason it's covered in here a lot is because Germany, I think, is the only place in the world where they actually have succeeded politically to elect candidates to their parliament. They've got like 28 green legislators in the German parliament, or Bundestag, it's called. Once you get more than 5% of the vote in Germany, you can put your people into the legislature, whereas in Congress, you know, it's very difficult for third-party candidates to get anybody into Congress. You actually have to win a majority in some district, or a plurality at least, I guess, in order to be able to get a congressperson in. Whereas in Germany, their elections are nationwide, and if you pick up more than 5% of the vote, your party can be represented in the legislature. Yes?
It looks like, the way I understand participatory, other than mastery situation, that it isn't another political system, but it's another model to sit opposite.
Yeah, almost, that's right. It's not even politics, right?
No,
as we think of it.
Doesn't I don't really understand what participatory democracy would involve. Doesn't it almost necessitate the commitment of each person within the democracy to live responsibly? I can see why
much more so.
People would be afraid
much more so.
To let go of a political police system because they understand that there are many people within society who would not police themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Can you say something about that?
I agree it's idealistic. And I agree that there's a lot of fear of letting go of social structures, hierarchical structures. I think the policing is not so much under the grassroots part as it is under the nonviolent part. And it's how do you work out the proper role of policing within a country to avoid basically oppression of peoples or political arrests and that kind of thing.
Does that book go into that a little bit?
It does. It discusses both those principles at quite length. Does it talk specifically about policing, internal policing of a country? Not very well, no.
Does it talk more on incarceration and removal of capital punishment? And
oh, I'm sure.
I don't think there's anything
yeah.
you can...
I mean, like Nicaragua, as soon as they Sandinistas took over, they abolished capital punishment. First thing they did, one of the first things they did.
Right.
It would involve a whole different philosophy toward rehabilitation than strict incarceration. But that's not dealt with. Thank you all.